This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Before we hear from Will Arnett, let's listen to Terry's interview with actress Margot Martindale. She played the secretary in the 2010 film Secretariat and Hilary Swank's mother in Million Dollar Baby. And now, Margot Martindale is up for her first Emmy for her role as Mags Bennett in the FX series Justified. Mags Bennett is the brutal matriarch of a drug empire in Kentucky coal mining country. In this scene, Mags is disciplining her not-very-bright son for leaving a paper trail that could incriminate the family. As this clip begins, she picks up a hammer.
I'm sorry, Mama.
Cooper, I know you're sorry. That's why it's going to hurt so much to have to do this.
Hey! Put your hand on his stump! Hey, put your hand on his stump!
Take what's coming.
Mama.
I'm saving your gun hand now.
Mama, don't hurt me.
Cross me again and I will leave you.
Mama!
Mama,
you
gotta do this.
You shut your mouth!
Mama!
Because you're crippled to the point of worthlessness. It ain't you down on that table. As it is, I have to hurt Cooper. And I like Cooper.
Mama, I love you. Mama, I love you. Mama, no!
Margot Martindale, welcome to Fresh Air, and please don't hurt me.
Oh, that really makes me laugh.
It's such an amazing scene. And, I mean, you're playing it both ways. Like, you're the loving mother who has to do this as if you're about to spank your baby, but you're about to break his every finger in his hand with a hammer. But you're nice enough to spare his gun hand.
I know, isn't
that sweet? Because you love him that much.
So sweet.
Tell me what it was like to play that scene.
Well, you know, it was everything about this part just came so easily, and I had
that scares me. I have to tell you.
I know, it's so crazy, but those boys were just fantastic. Brad Hinkey and Jeremy Davies and Joe Lyle Taylor, my sons. We had a blast. It was like doing a 6-month movie. It was just, it was easy. That's all I can say. Very easy. That scene, the only thing I worried about was hurting his hand. It was a rubber hammer, but I kept saying, oh, please, Brad, if it hurts, let me know. And, of course, I think it hurt a little bit, but, you know, that's okay. He deserved it.
So you were telling me right before we went on the air that you actually used this scene as your Emmy submission scene.
I did. I mean, you know, I guess people have people to do that, but I have myself, really. And I watched lots of different, there's so much to choose from, but it's only 18 seconds, the most that they use. So that was the most concise scene that I thought actually was funny, too. I think it's funny, but, you know, that's my warped sense of humor. So that's the scene I chose.
So you are a really tough, cold, brutal woman in this, who also has this really folksy side. Like, the first time we see you, you're serving your bootleg liquor, which is affectionately known as your apple pie. So you have these like two sides, like the veneer, which is the folksy side, and the really brutal, drug kingpin side beneath that. What was your audition like? They called you. I know that they called you for this role. What did they, whoever it was, from Justified, know about you?
You know what? I don't know what they knew about me, because I was in Los Angeles for the premiere of Secretariat. And my agent
Where you played the secretary?
I played the secretary in Secretariat. But I wasn't the horse. So
thank you.
That's a good thing. But I was staying out to do an episode of Harry's Law, because Kathy Bates and I are old friends. And he said, would you like to go audition for this part? They wanted to see you for this Kentucky woman drug dealer. I said, oh, really? Do I have to audition for that? Can't they just look at my reel? And he said, no, they really want to hear you say the words. So then I got the script and read it. And I said, I'll go anywhere to do this. Just tell me where to go. So I went and, just with the casting director, read the scene, read most all of the scenes of the first episode. And two hours later, they offered me the part.
They were so right. Where did you go? Who did you watch? Did you watch movies? Did you visit Harlan County? What did you do to get into this?
I just came right out of me. I didn't do anything. I'm from Texas. I'm from East Texas. I'm from big land-owning people, big ranchers, big hunters, big athletes. They all talk like that. They're all smart and deceptive and powerful. And also, I lived 4 years in Kentucky at Actors Theater of Louisville. So it's all part of my makeup. You know, it's something I really understand. I'd like to say that I worked really hard and studied people and everything, but I didn't. It just came out of my imagination and the 60 years I've lived, truly.
I think one of your great tools is your voice. You have a really deep voice that you can make even deeper in roles like Justified. You can bring your voice from really like deep within. And I have to say that this is at a time when a lot of women speak in much higher voices, and when often our voices get more trapped in our throats for women. Mm. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about your voice and using how deep and full it can be in a role like your role on Justified,
where
you have to express power. You have to convey you've got the power.
Sometimes I worry that my voice is too buzzy, too round. That when I'm on stage, I really have to lift my voice. I have to put it in another spot so that you can hear me, because sometimes when you're down in this thing, you can't hear the enunciation as well. I remember when I was in high school, the biology teacher said to my favorite teacher, Mr. Billy Gwynn, said to the students, "Now listen to Margot Martindale's voice. Now she's probably got more male genes in her voice." I thought, "What in the hell is that?" Thank you, Mr. Gwynn. Oh boy. My voice is lower than I have both of my brothers, but one of them is not with me anymore. But my voice is lower than their voices. Texas men usually have a little bit higher voices like that. But mine's lower than, my mother had a very low voice too. So I don't know. Sometimes I feel that it is a plus, and sometimes I think that it gets in my way, my voice.
Why does it get in your way sometimes?
And maybe Justified has changed that for me in my head. Sometimes I think I have to pretty it up, girlify it, make it more, make it a little sweeter, a little softer, a little more, you know, have a little more, because everybody I talked to on the phone has said, "Yeah, yes, sir. No, sir." I said, "This is a woman." I've said, "This is a woman," I must say, maybe 2,500 times in my life. This is a woman, and I get really pissy about it.
This is why I'm so grateful to the people in Justified for allowing you to, like, unleash your gifts.
they just let me run wild. Isn't that wonderful? It was really, really liberating, I can tell you that. It also, I think because I let it go, I let everything except that I loved to act and I loved to be honest and true to the character. That's all that I cared about. And I didn't care what I look like. I didn't care obviously I didn't care what I look like. I care what I look like. I care that I'm fat. I care, but Mags Bennett did not care. And I love that about Mags Bennett. So maybe...
Well, her size is part of her power.
So maybe she's taught me something. I hope so.
You just described yourself as fat.
Yes.
I'd use the word plump or something, but...
You're so sweet.
Thank you. But, I read that when you were in high school, you were a cheerleader, and
I
you
was
were,
a
like,
cheerleader.
The football homecoming queen or something along those
I
lines?
I was the football sweetheart in the ninth grade. I was Miss Jacksonville High School in high school. But I was never the homecoming queen. Let's get that straight, because people really get mad when they read that.
But I imagine you had, you know, quite an attractive figure then to be a cheerleader.
I had a really lovely figure. I did. Surprise!
Did it upset you when you started putting on weight?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, uh-huh. It's always, I wore a body brace all during my teenage years, from when I was 12 until I was 15.
For like scoliosis or something?
For severe scoliosis. They think I had polio when I was 3 and that it, when my spine grew, that it grew crooked. So I wore a body brace and I wore prism glasses to see. I was extremely small. And then when I got out of that brace, I put on, I'd say, 20 pounds almost immediately because I felt very vulnerable. So I...
Oh, because you didn't have this, like, a brace protecting you.
I didn't have a body. I didn't have armor around me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but I'm talking, then I weighed 140 pounds instead of 120 pounds. And then after my father died, I gained 70 pounds. Then I lost that 70 pounds. And I stayed all right until I had a child. And then I just said, to hell with it, and went with it. Now I'd love to lose some weight. Mm-hmm. So there.
Margot Martindale speaking with Terry Gross earlier this week. After the break, Martindale tells us what it was like to work with Clint Eastwood in Million Dollar Baby. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with actress Margot Martindale, who guest starred as Mags Bennett for the entire 2011 season of the FX series Justified. Terry spoke with Margot Martindale earlier this week.
The first time I noticed you was in the Clint Eastwood movie Million Dollar Baby, which starred Hilary Swank as a young boxer who was really kind of going against the odds because she's a woman, and she's being trained by an over-the-hill boxer trainer played by Clint Eastwood. And when she starts to win matches, she buys her mother, you, and her sister's child a house. Now, they're all on welfare. They don't really care about her. They're what some people might call white trash.
Yeah, some people.
When she takes you and your daughter to your new home that she bought you to surprise you all, the big surprise is your reaction. So here's the scene with Hilary Swank and you as her mother. You speak first.
How much money this cost?
You never mind that.
Well, you shouldn't have done this.
You need a decent place.
You shouldn't have done it. You should have asked me first. Darling, government's going to find out about this house. They're going to stop my welfare.
Oh, no, they ain't.
Yeah, they are. You're fine. You're working, but I can't live without my welfare.
Mama, I send you money.
What about my medicine? Medicaid going to cut me off. How am I supposed to get my medicine?
I'll send you more money.
I hope you don't expect JD to move in here with us. He's getting out, you know.
Why don't you just give me the money? Would you have to buy me a house?
I didn't have to, Mama. But it's yours. You want the money? Sell it.
What gratitude you display. In that scene, that was really just such a stunning role. I saw that and I was wondering, who is that actress? Because I don't think I'd really seen you in much before that, or I hadn't really noticed. It's a great role where you are a very unappealing character. Do you have fun with roles like that where you have to really play unappealing, ungrateful?
I think they're the most fun. The only thing you lose mostly in those parts is that sense of humor. It's not being funny. I think some of those parts are funny, but only funny in how brutal they are. You have to let the bounce and music of repartee go away. You can't be sophisticated in that way when you play those parts, but they've given me the most joy.
So how did you prepare for this part, for instance?
You know, same kind of thing. I mean, it was sort of a lead-in to Justified, I think. I was in Los Angeles again. They asked me to come in and audition for that part. And I said, I want to wait till I get back to New York because I want this part. And I feel more comfortable auditioning in New York. It's a weird thing. You feel more comfortable at home. And I did the whole part. I learned the whole part. I did the whole part. And I think that's the way you get it for Clint Eastwood. If you're not a star, you really have to show him the whole thing done.
Did he give you any advice or, you know, any notes at the audition?
He wasn't there. He's never there.
And
When I got that, when we did it, he said, "We love what you did. Just do it that way." So he just kind of let me do whatever I wanted to do. It was nice. He's wonderful.
No, he was one of the stars of the film, playing the manager of the boxer. And there's a scene at the end after the young woman boxer, played by Hilary Swank, has broken her neck. She's lying helplessly in her bed. She's paralyzed from the neck down. And you and your daughter, like the whole family, comes in, basically putting a document under her nose and telling her to sign it with her mouth because it's the only part of her body that moves, willing everything she owns to you for when she dies. And Clint Eastwood is in the doorway staring really hostily at you. And I'm wondering what the experience was like of having your director, because he directed the film as well, in the doorway staring hostily at you as you were trying to do your scene.
Oh, honestly, that scene, the first part of the movie, first two scenes that I did, then I went home and my brother died.
Oh, my God.
And, and when I came back, he was so kind to me that what I really was doing during all of that last scene was trying very hard not to be emotional about it. So it was, everybody was extremely supportive, and it was all about me not giving in to my own life experiences during that time. He couldn't be more lovely and wonderful as a director and a person.
Would you mind if I asked how your brother died?
He died of outpatient surgery.
Oh, no. Well, like a staph infection or something?
No. He blew a blood clot in the morning. He went home after having some kind of hernia operation. And.
Oh, no.
And, died. He called me before he got... Actually, he had a hernia operation and one of his testicles removed. I'm sorry, Tim. But he called me when he got home. He said, Hi, sister. I'm going to go to sleep. Then he said, I'm tired. And I said, oh, Tim, you're ridiculous. And then he said, I'll call you tomorrow. And he was dead. So it was really shocking and hard. And he was 58 years old.
So he was an older brother.
He was 5 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And I have another brother 13 years older than me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really sorry.
No, thank you.
So I'm thinking, a lot of actors are given the advice to kind of, like, find the emotion within you, play yourself in a way, be your version of that character. And from how you're describing it, you had to make sure you were not in touch with your emotions because your emotions are so raw at that moment. Did you have to draw on a completely different way of acting because what you were experiencing was so profound and so, so bad? So you were in such grief.
I never thought about that, but yes, I guess I did. Though I think that approaching that scene, I would have shut down that part of me anyway, because I'm very empathic, and I would have been affected emotionally by that scene as me. So I had to actually, like in Justified, shut down that part of me that feels for people. So that part of my brain was not there.
There's one other movie I want to ask you about, and I don't know how many people saw this. There's an independent film called Paris, Je T'aime, and it was about 12 very short films put together in this one anthology, all having to do with Paris. And you're the star of the final film, and it's basically your film. You're the only character we follow in this film. It's largely done in a voiceover, and the premise is that inspired by your adult education French class, you've decided to take a week in Paris on vacation. Now you're a postal worker. You're single. You're kind of lonely. You don't have much of a life outside your job, but you've gone to Paris. You're a very unsophisticated traveler. There's a lot about Paris you really don't get, but you just start coming alive during the course of this short film, and it ends with this just lovely moment where you're sitting on a park bench in Paris, just like watching the people in the park, watching, seeing the grass and the sunshine. And in the voiceover, you say something to the effect that you feel the joy and sadness of being alive. And you've woken up. You are alive in a way that you hadn't been before, even though you're still alone. But something's been turned on within you. And it's a beautiful moment. We see it in your face, and it's such a nice performance. And then your voiceover, the premise is that you're basically reading your journal to the French class, and you're not very good at French, so you're reading it in this just really heavily American-accented French that probably no French person would ever be able to understand. I love this character, and it's different from the other characters we've been talking about because she's not a heavy. She could have been a real, like, stereotyped, lonely, middle-aged woman, but you don't play her that way.
That's so sweet. I loved doing that. That and Justified and Million Dollar Baby. You've picked the three my favorite things I ever did. Alexander Payne called me up.
He wrote and directed your segment. Yeah.
He wrote and directed my segment. And he said, Margo, this is Alexander Payne. Do you remember me? I said, yeah. He said, I've written something. I've written it for you. I've never written for anyone before. And there's no money in it. And would you like to come to Paris and do it? I said, let me think about that. Yes. Then we hung up. He explained a little bit about what it was. We hung up and called me back. And he said, by the way, do you speak French? I said, not a word. And he said, oh, that's even better. So when we got there, and they brought my husband and me, and we had a fabulous time in Paris. And I'd never been to Paris, so that was really perfect for that character. We shot that last scene first.
Why?
So after we did that last scene, Alexander said, well, everything else is gravy. He also had me watch, before I got there, Fellini film that he wanted to, the leading character, he kind of wanted me to have a feeling of this woman, and that's what kind of what you see in there. And I can never remember the name of this movie, but it's Cabrini.
Knights of Cabiria.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, I tried to have her feeling of innocence. There's an innocence about her that I tried to, it's very, very like a child seeing something for the first time.
What's it like to play, like, the epiphany before you've played everything leading
well,
up to it?
Well, you know what? It was in a park in Paris in the 14th arrondissement, and I was sitting on a park bench, and I could start. This was like being me, this thing. I was sitting on a park bench, and I went from looking at some old people on a bench and thinking of my mother and all the people that were gone to panning over to seeing a playground full of children and thinking of my daughter growing up. And it just was there, just immediately.
Oh. Well, I could see how it would be there because the emotion is still so there.
It's just, you know, it's all about life. It was so easy. I'm sorry. It was so easy to do.
Oh.
Yeah. And so everything else was just, you know, and Alexander directed me as if he were directing a silent movie, which was fantastic. It was a perfect combination for me.
Can I just say what you've just demonstrated is just the opposite of what you had to do, you know, going back to when after your brother died and you were playing this like callous mother in Million Dollar Baby, when you said you had to shut down your own feeling to play that scene because you were just feeling such grief and you had to be so cold. And in this, you totally drew on, in Parashat Tem, you totally drew on yourself, on your own yeah. experiences, your own memories, your loss, the pleasure of watching your daughter grow up. And that emotion is still obviously so with you. So,
yeah, well, you know, it's with us all, isn't it? All what we've lived through. That's the most wonderful part about getting older
and
having experience in life. I mean, I played Big Mama in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof when I was 20 years old at the University of Michigan. And then I played Big Mama on Broadway in 2004. Where the speech at the end of that play, time goes by so quickly, nothing can outrun it, death commences too early, even before you're half acquainted with life, you meet with the other. Boy, did that have different weight from when I was 20 years old to when I was 50-some-odd years old. It's all about just what you've experienced. You can't teach that to a younger actor. You have to have lived it, I think.
My guest is Margot Martindale, and she's co-starring in a new TV series that premieres soon. It's called A Gifted Man. And in this one, you're the assistant to a surgeon who's gifted in two senses. He's brilliant at diagnosis and surgery, and he's discovered a new gift, a supernatural one. He can actually see and communicate with his ex-wife, who returns to him after she's killed in a car accident. And she wants a favor. She wants him to care for the patients at the free clinic that she ran while she was alive. He has a very wealthy practice, and she ran a free clinic for poor people, so he has to decide what to do at the end of the first episode, and he's totally baffled by this whole supernatural experience. But anyways, you're his assistant, and I'm going to play a scene from early on with you and the surgeon, who's played by Patrick Wilson. Do you want to say anything before hearing the scene?
Well, number one, I think he is delicious, Patrick Wilson, and we have incredible chemistry, and I love medical shows, and I love ghosts. So that is the part, and I think other people do too. And I'm excited about it.
Good, good. Well, let's hear the scene from episode one.
You have an 8 a.m. staff meeting, then the two back-to-back gliomas. Mm. Madeline needs 15 minutes.
Put her in at lunch.
Can't. You'll be doing a consult with Lacey Sandreski. Lacey Sandreski.
Lacey Sandreski.
She's 19 years old, ranked number one. In the last 12 months, she's won Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the Australian Open. And if she wins the French, which starts next week, she'll be the youngest woman ever to win a Grand Slam.
What's her consult about?
Her father wouldn't say, just that they need to see you ASAP. one more thing. It's my birthday.
Again?
Once a year, like everyone else. Lynn's taking me to Jean-Luc. I'm leaving at 6.
Jean-Luc is overrated. Madeline.
I need 15 minutes.
I told him. Happy birthday, Rita. Why, thank you, Michael.
Margot Martindale in a scene from her new TV series, A Gifted Man. So this is a relatively, like, normal person that you're playing. Judging from the first episode, you know, we've heard so many, like, you know, like brutal and weird and or very, like, interior kind of roles that you've played. And here you're like a really competent working professional.
Isn't that a surprise? I've tried to make her a drunk who had gone to rehab, but they wouldn't let me.
Why'd you want to do that? Add a little bit of color?
Just to give me something more, yes. I like complicated people.
Margot Martindale, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this week. You can hear a clip of Martindale singing in the online version of her Fresh Air interview at freshair.npr.org. Coming up after the break, we'll hear Terry's interview with Will Arnett. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Will Arnett played Job the Magician, the bad magician, in the dysfunctional Bluth family on Arrested Development, the comedy cult series that aired on Fox from 2003 to 2006. This year, Arnett's guest-starring role on NBC's 30 Rock as a competitive TV executive earned him an Emmy nomination. Now, Will Arnett stars opposite Christina Applegate as a sleep-deprived dad in the NBC sitcom Up All Night, which premiered earlier this week. It's about a married couple trying to adjust to their lives as new parents. Arnett plays a lawyer who has put his career on hold to be a stay-at-home dad, allowing his wife to return to her job as the producer of a TV talk show. The host of that talk show is played by Maya Rudolph. Before we get to Terry's conversation with Will Arnett, let's hear a clip from Up All Night. In this scene, Arnett and Applegate face the morning, exhausted.
Oh, my God.
At least you don't have to work.
Yeah, because raising a human's no work at all.
God, I got no sleep last night. I mean, I was up with Amy from 1 to 4.
Well, I was up from 10 to midnight. You probably don't remember that. Because you were asleep. While I was awake.
No, you were asleep when I got up at 1. Because I saw you. I mean, because I was awake.
No, I'm sure you were groggy from being in such a deep sleep that you did not see that my eyes were wide open and I was indeed awake.
No, you were asleep because I saw everything because I was wide awake. Totally awake. With my eyes open.
Except for when you were completely asleep. I mean, when your eyes were closed in what I would call an asleep-like fashion.
Are you kidding me?
Because I was wide awake. I watched you sleeping. I stood over you watching you sleep. Do you want to do it real quick?
No, I don't want to do it real quick. I can't even think about...
That's not even your real sex face.
Stop talking.
I wish it was.
Will Arnett, welcome to Fresh Air. So is it weird to have a TV wife and a TV baby on the set and then have a real wife and a real baby at home?
It is weird. First of all, I mean, it's weird for me, but also trying to explain that to your kids. I mean, I have two young kids, but my wife and I were watching the pilot when we got the first cut earlier this summer and at home in New York, and our son came in the room and he kind of looked at the TV with a puzzled look on his face, and on the screen I'm holding one of the babies on the show, and I paused the show, and he said that's Dada's brother, and I said no, that's Dada, and he said that's Dada's baby, and I said no, that's Dada's baby, but it's not real, and he said no, that baby's real, and I said yes, it is a real baby, and I was thinking, how do I explain this to a 2.5-year-old? It was just, you know, it was very difficult.
Who is the baby? How do you get like an infant for a show?
The baby is played by two young babies, twins. And it has to be twins because of child labor laws. So they can only work, you know, X amount of hours. So they need twins in order to, otherwise we'd have 4-hour shoot days. So I often imagine that if you give birth to twins in the Los Angeles area, they probably have studio and network people close by ready to sign you up.
It's a weird thought, you know, to think of working on a TV set before you're teething, before you can say anything except mama, papa, you know?
Yeah, it's very strange. And, you know, Christina and I were talking about it the other day on set, and we were thinking, you know, if this show were to go longer than a few episodes or, you know, longer, if it were to go on for a few years, we're going to be in the lives of these, in the early lives of these two babies, Carly and Delaney, who play our daughter Amy. It's going to be, we are going to be forever a big part of their early years. So that's quite strange. And it's a responsibility too. I mean, not only is it a responsibility as a parent to be in your own kid's life, but also in somebody else's life, kid's life. That in and of itself is a big responsibility.
Well, do you know for sure that if the show lasts, say, 5 years or something, that it'll be the same babies? I mean, do they have a 5-year contract?
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. We could fire those babies anytime.
That's what I'm thinking. So in Up All Night, you play somebody who's funny, but is a kind of normal person, unlike some of the other characters you play who are just so quirky. So
that's kind.
What word would you use?
Arch.
Arch. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. So how is it for you to be playing somebody who's kind of like a, you know, a normal person?
Yeah, I was very excited to play this character because I have played a lot of characters who were, you know, over the top or arch or evil or out of touch with reality. And I did so because I was always really attracted to those kinds of roles because they were kind of funny to me. I love characters who are really confident and dumb. I just love that combination. But then even I tired of it. But when I read this character, when I read this show, it was the first time that I ever really identified with a character. And I thought, yeah, I know who this is. This is really close to me. It's not me, but it's close to me, and I could see myself being a version of this. And it's been nice. It's kind of like I'm switching gears a little bit. And it's nice to be able to play these real moments in the show and not have to pay it off with some grandiose statement at the end of it or say something dastardly.
Give me an example of the grandiose statement or the dastardly statement that you typically had to do in, say, Arrested Development.
You know, in Arrested Development, it would be something like, you're my brother, and I love you, and I will always love you. And then the person walks out of the room, because I know you're going to die soon. You know. And I will be the one to take you down. You know. So it was very rare. Or there would be moments where you'd have, you know, in Arrested Development, there's a moment where I think it's when Job finds out that Steve Holt is his son. And he kind of turns away. I forget what the line was. And then Mitch Hurwitz went to town with the sort of soap opera music underneath, you know, to a crescendo. By the way, aiding my performance 1,000,000%, making me seem a lot better than I was. But, you know, Mitch never lets a moment, he always undercuts real moments. And he feels like that's his job as a comedy writer.
We actually have a scene from Arrested Development, which may or may not illustrate what you're talking about. It has a funny last line. So this is a scene from season one, and your character, Job, is among other things, a magician. And so in this episode, you think your girlfriend, Marta, who's a Mexican soap opera actress, is cheating on you. And it turns out she actually has a crush on your brother, played by Jason Bateman. And your brother has just found this out, and he just really doesn't know what to do. And in the meantime, you're thinking, look, she's got a crush on somebody else. She's having an affair with somebody else. When you find out who that person is, you're gonna beat them up. And you're telling this to your brother, the person she actually has the crush on. And you've overheard her on the phone talking about hermano. And you think that she's got a crush on hermano when that actually means brother. And it's actually your brother. So here's the scene where Jason Bateman, who plays your brother Michael, is talking to you.
Hey, Job. Marta call?
She sure has. Four times, but I didn't take the calls.
Oh, no? Why not?
Because of you. You said to lay low, and it's working.
Great.
Tell you what, you may not be good with women, but you are great with other people's women. I'll give you that.
Oh. Listen, Job, you can't just ignore her. Maybe you should talk to her. She is your girlfriend.
Exactly. And I want to keep it that way. For all I know, she's calling to break up with me. I don't answer the phone. That doesn't happen. And it's all because of you, Fratello. It's Italian for brothers. Now all I gotta do is find this hermano guy. I'm gonna kill him.
Hey, brother.
Hey, Busty.
Oh, hey, brother.
Hey, Buster.
Job, there's no need for violence. There never is. I like to think that we're all, you know, intelligent, mature, and adults that can settle their differences whenever they might come to light through words.
Yeah, well, I let my fists do the talking. Not this one, because obviously I need it for coin tricks and stuff.
Okay, so that's my guest, Will Arnett, in an episode of Arrested Development. So the voice that you just did, It reminds me that you've done a lot of like voiceovers for commercials, and I think you've done voices for video games. I know you've done voices for animations. So I guess I'm interested in some of the other characters that have been rattling around your head that you've channeled for voices that you've done.
I did the voice of the chef in Ratatouille, which is the story of the rat who becomes a chef, and it was directed by Brad Bird, who's a legend in animation circles and in, I guess, the world now. And when I first went in, I didn't get the... Usually you get the, you know, the breakdown of the what the character is and what the story is, but in animation they don't often send you the whole script, which is really weird. So you just kind of show up and you've got some sort of idea, and they might send you some artwork so you can see what your character looks like. And in that particular case, I got the wrong stuff, or it didn't get sent to me. So I get there and Brad Bird says to me, you got to do a German. So that, you know, he's talking me through it and stuff. And then he said, and, you know, of course, Horst is this German guy. And I thought, German. I'm thinking, oh, my God, German. What is he talking? This is the first I'm hearing about it. And I'm about to record. And I guess in that moment, I had to kind of conjure up my best bar trick German accent. And it ended up being okay because he was there and he really talked me through it. But other things like, you know, I did a voice in Despicable Me. And I played the banker who was bankrolling all of Steve Carell's character's dastardly exploits. So they showed me the art for it, and he was like this huge kind of overweight guy, and he's this banker, and he's this sort of supposed to be this awful guy. And I wanted to make him sound like he, every time he said the word money, like he was seeing a platter of food. I want him to feel like he wanted to eat money, so that he ends up saying, like, let me tell you something, Gru. The most important thing is money. And it's just sort of dripping and drooling when he says that word. And that really always made me laugh.
So what were the first voiceovers you got?
The first paying voiceover gig I ever got was for a company, I don't even know if they're still in business, called Harvard Community Health Plan, which is a Boston-based, you know, New England healthcare provider. And so even when I was 23, I had a pretty gravelly voice for, and I looked really young. And that particular job, because it was quite a big job, I had to fly up to Boston and do all the stuff there in the studio. And I think that they were quite shocked to see how young I looked, because I probably looked like I was 18 at most when I was 23. And the copy was all reassuring kind of healthcare stuff, you know, like, don't worry, we'll take care of everything you need. We're Harvard, you know. And then here comes this young punk.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Will Arnett, and he stars with Christina Applegate and Maya Rudolph in the new TV series Up All Night. This year, Arnett was nominated for an Emmy for his guest starring performance on 30 Rock. I'll let him describe the role.
Well, on 30 Rock, I play the character of Devin Banks, who, when I first started on that show a few years ago, Devin worked at GE or NBC. And he was like the West Coast equivalent of Alec Baldwin's character. So he was a guy who was very ambitious and is gay. And when somebody mentions that, Alec Baldwin's character says that makes him doubly dangerous. And he comes to New York, and he and Devin and Alec's character spent a lot of time vying for the top position at the company. He's a totally unscrupulous, you know, blind with ambition guy who ends up kind of getting eaten up by the machine and tossed out, and he disappears off the scene. And in this past season, he comes back, Alec Baldwin's character, and goes and looks for him and finds him in a domestic situation. He and his partner have three adopted babies, and Alec needs him to help him out. And he thinks, wow, he's really dropped off the face and he's not in it anymore. And then in one fell swoop, my character rips his tracksuit off to reveal that he's in a full suit and that he's been waiting for this moment that Jack needs him for his whole life.
And what Jack needs him to do is to run a new gay network that is being started by the company that bought NBC. So I'm going to play a scene that relates to exactly what you've been describing. So this is after your character becomes the head of this network, and he's become like kind of pals with the head of Cablevision, Hank Hooper, because they both have kids, and you know they've kind of bonded over their children. And so now he's really kind of in competition with Jack, and he seems to be besting Jack. So here are you with Alec Baldwin and Jack, and you speak first.
Morning, Jack.
Oh, my. Empty coffee pot. Same cheap $300 tie as yesterday. Nose hair all askew. You've been here all night trying to figure out how to fight back, haven't you?
How was your play date with the Hoopers?
Oh, it was amazing. Yes, really superlative tummy time. Oh, I almost forgot. Hank, Uncle Hank, wants to expand overseas, and he's chosen me to be the face of the company in Europe. That's right. I've been promoted.
But Europe is my purview. I was supposed to go there next week. I was going to take a picture where it looked like I was holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Now I'll be taking that picture. Do you have any idea how strong I'll look? I vanquished you in one day. I was trapped in a world of wet wipes and rectal thermometers. Then the babies came and life changed. But you set me free, Jack. Now it's weekends in New York, then jet-setting around the world in economy plus. I'll be thousands of miles away from the chaos in Brooklyn. Do you know what it's like to have triplets? It's just everything times three. Three pairs of grubby little hands smearing food all over your brand new chihuahua outfits. Three pairs of feet in their weird, soft little shoes. Two pairs of eyes, brown, like my husband's. Three perfect little mouths that smile every time I walk through the door. Three tummies that just want their num-nums and Zerberts. Oh, God, I just love my babies too much. I can't leave.
It's my guest Will Arnett and Alec Baldwin in a scene from 30 Rock. So it must be so much fun to do that show.
It's really, really fun. Those scripts are always hilarious. You know, I get to show up and play this really fun, insane character and kind of be unapologetically awful. And yeah, it's really fun to do that.
Will Arnett speaking with Terry Gross earlier this week. You'll find a much longer version of Terry's interview with Will Arnett on our website. We'll leave you with one last scene from Arrested Development. Here, Will Arnett's character Job shares a moment with his brother Michael, played by Jason Bateman, before taking the stage.
Okay, it's magic time.
Hey, good luck out there now.
Hey, listen, I got you something. For being such a good guy. Not that it's a surprise, you always are.
Oh, well, my watch.
I want you to have it.
Well, you've stolen so many things from me over the years. It's the first time you've ever given something back.
I want to try to be a better brother, like you are to me.
We're ready for you.
Job. Have a good show out there.
Ladies and gentlemen, a magician named God.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Frigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, and Heidi Saman. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. Coming up, comic actor Will Arnett. On Arrested Development, he played Job the magician, the bad magician, in the dysfunctional